Hello and welcome to Holden. It is Friday, July 23rd, 1999, and in Fireside is Deanne Lagerquist, Tools for Cultivating Monastic Communities, number 99-3. Let's listen in.
I think I know most of you, but for the sake of the radio audience, my name is Deanne Lagerquist, and when I am not at Holden, I am most often to be found in Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach at St. Olaf College. I'm trained as a church historian, but several factors, including teaching undergraduates and a personality that mitigates against specialization, mean that I range much more widely than just history in its narrowest, most technical sense. Tonight we're going to talk about monasticism, and I thought I'd start by just very, very basically saying something about what monasticism is in my understanding of it. It's a specialized form of religious life. The term monasticism means to live alone, but as often happens, the truth is that monasticism has come to refer more often to people who live in community than it does to those who live alone, the hermits or the anchorites, and particularly that's the case in the Benedictine form of monasticism, which is where we're going to focus tonight. So there's however, another way of thinking about this living alone that I think is very accurate when we think about monasticism. If you can think of it instead of living alone, but living for one thing, that there's a singleness of life about the monastic life. And in the case of the Benedictines, to borrow a phrase from one of its most notable scholars, Jean Leclerc, it's governed by a desire for God. That's the heart of the matter, this desire for God. And then that's governed by the rule of Saint Benedict. So, but before we look at that more carefully, I have to back up, since I'm charged this week with talking about the summer theme. I have to bring in all this tree business, which I've been having great fun with. The summer theme, of course, the tree of life, and then this series of mine, bearing the fruit of the tree. Through these days, we've looked especially at some of the writing that Gail Ramshaw has done about the tree of life. She uses the image for the title of this autobiographical book, Under the Tree of Life, The Religion of a Feminist Christian, which I've just been very excited by what Gail Ramshaw does in here. She's this sort of theologian who makes all purists angry. So that recommends her well to me, that feminists of a certain purist stripe don't think she's radical enough. And people who care about the liturgy think she plays a little too fast and loose with it. And so she's in that place. One of my seminary classmates used to say about Lutherans, the problem with being in the middle is you get hit by trucks going from each direction. And Gail Ramshaw has a little bit of that. But this is an autobiographical piece. We've also looked a little bit yesterday, and I'm not going to read this all again today, but in this book that was originally published under the title Letters for God's Name, it's now out by a different publisher called The Metaphorical God. It's an ABC book. And the T is about the tree. I'm only going to read you the first paragraph tonight. She writes, God's grove of trees, the tree of life set in Eden, the tree from which we have not yet tasted. But an old legend says that Seth took a seed from the sacred tree and planted it in the grave of Father Adam's mouth. From that seed grew a towering tree around which hovered healing powers. From that tree was built a wooden bridge over the waters at Siloam, and there the Queen of Sheba prophesied a coming glory. From that ramshackle bridge's scrap lumber was finally constructed a cross, which, when exhumed by pious Helena, restored a dead man to life, the true cross. This image of the tree of life is one that's very powerful to us for several reasons. And Ramshaw says, I didn't bring it in her book, God Beyond Gender, that we should reappropriate, we should pay more attention to this image for at least these reasons. One, it helps restore a respect for the created world. Two, it connects us with other traditions. And three, the tree of life is a very rich image that encompasses not just the beauty of the blossoms in the spring, but also death and disappointment and fear and danger, and especially, of course, when we see that connection between the tree of life in Revelation 22 and the cross. So it's a remarkable image. The tree in Revelation 22 has these 12 fruits, each in its own season. And my image of bearing good fruit, of course, shifts that a little bit. That if we live under the tree, we eat the fruit, somehow we become the tree. Now, that may seem strange to literal-minded late 20th century Americans, that this image shifts around like that, but really that's how good metaphors work. They move us from one to the other. I'm reminded of to look forward to tomorrow's session on a Lutheran way of life. What Luther says in his commentary on the Galatians about how the water falls on the just and the unjust alike, and then when we have been grasped by passive righteousness, we become the rain that falls on the just and the unjust alike. So that's kind of what I'm playing with here, that we live under this tree, we feed on the tree, and we become what we eat, namely a tree that bears fruit. Okay, so then two other tree incidents to start us off on a very brief and in some ways superficial examination of what we might learn from the Benedictines. The first is an incident that took place in the 600s in the life of Saint Boniface. Boniface was a missionary, a Benedictine missionary from England, an Anglo-Saxon, he was called at that time, back to the continent of Germany. You may realize that, well, I don't need a map, you can visualize this, that Christianity spreads around the Mediterranean, up through southern France, more through the Frankish tribes than the Germanic tribes, into England. And then up into the hills, and things go on with the empire, and then later, partly with St. Helena, when Christianity is reestablished, it goes back across the channel from England into Germany, and Boniface is a major important force in that. As many of those early medieval missionaries, he didn't have a lot of success initially, and there's this wonderful dramatic story when he encountered people whose worship was of the thunder god. In the Scandinavian tradition, that's Thor, Thundor. Maybe in the Germanic tradition, it's a sky god. And this sky god was associated with groves, particularly groves of oaks. And rather like one of those Old Testament prophet stories, what Boniface does is chop down Thor's oak, and nothing bad happened to him, right? So we have this remarkable example that kind of has to make us come back and say, oh, but not every tree is the tree of life. Even though Ramshaw wants us to think about all those connections to the other traditions, Boniface is saying, no, the tree of Thor is not, that oak is not the tree that gives you life. The tree that gives you life is the cross. And what he plants there, particularly in Fulda, is a monastic community. And it grows, and St. Leo becomes and is there, and wonderful, wonderful stories about them. But we're not, that's not what we're about today. Just simply to have in mind that sort of judgment that Boniface's action suggests, that not every tree is the tree of life, not all fruit is sweet, not all leaves are healing. And then the second is less historically significant. It's a brief little incident narrated by Kathleen Norris in her book Dakota, and certainly of anyone, Kathleen Norris has probably done the most in the last decade to make Benedictine monasticism attractive to people. Although I have to say, I have some of my students read some of her essays and they still just go, no, no, this is too weird, no. Okay, so this is called Blessing. Monasteries are made for walking, and I think this accounts for much of the peace people find in them. Here in winter, when ice and the north wind make walking outside difficult, the long corridors and tunnels connecting the monastery, church, dining room, and library provide ample opportunity for walking, for meditating, for listening to the body's rhythms. One night in spring, Vespers ended with the whole community walking solemnly to the slow pace of a litany through the church and out the front door to the garden. The gardeners led us, carrying a processional cross, incense, and a few seedlings to be blessed. The cantors and the abbot brought up the rear. We called on the angels and Saint Isidore, patron of farmers. The long skirts of the monks' habits kept time. From all evil, deliver us, O Lord. From drought and pestilence, deliver us, O Lord. When we got to the garden, we made a circle, and the abbot led us in prayers, sprinkling holy water on the plants, on the well-weeded soil, and on us. In the wind, the monks' scapulars made a sound like the wings of the nighthawks wheeling above. This ritual is one of the most ancient known to humankind. In some parts of Europe, an icon of the Black Madonna, her skin as dark as the plowed soil, is still carried into the fields before planting. No matter what one believes in, there's something wonderful about blessing things. If they hold to tradition, this community will perform this ceremony in reverse in the early autumn, carrying the garden's first fruits to the church to be blessed, and proceeding on to the kitchen, blessing it, the utensils, and the cooks for good measure. The ceremony put us in a good mood. We stood in small groups, visiting. With the blue light of dusk came the smell of rain. A few drops, not enough to make much difference, but something. Bats began shooting from the pottery building to the monastery proper, and a novice, a shy, bearish young man, picked a spring of lilac to take to his room. He lumbered off with it, holding it close to his chest, the purple made more vivid by the severe black of his habit. Take more, an old monk called to him. Take more. Now, rather than pushing away and cutting down, this little incident really captures the joy that that desire of God is for. So we'll let those two stand for us. And I'm going to talk, I hope, briefly so that we might have time at the end to address some questions that I think the Benedictines have something to help us, offer us some help with. What do we value in our life as Christian people? How do we guard against the opposite? It's there in that chopping down of Thor. Not everything is the tree of life, but I also think there is, I'm going to talk about the vows as guarding against the opposite. What is the role for the community, both in how we organize our time and in how we organize our work, and maybe in some other ways? Because as I already indicated, there's this bizarre thing that monasticism, which is about which etymologically means living alone, turns out most often to be living with others in pursuit of one thing. And then, more specifically, what is the place for worship? Earlier in the week, we talked about the early church, the Didache, and noted that we have in common with them across time concern for the sacraments, for scripture, and the Lord's Prayer. I hope we'll also find some really basic commonalities between those of us who've never set foot in a monastery and those who live there day by day. And I know there are several people who here who have had ongoing relationships with various monastic communities. So here we go. Some key points I'm going to hope to make. Talk a little bit about the times in which the rule was composed. What it values, this first question. There's this image in the rule that I find very attractive, to live in God's tent. Is one way to talk about it. The desire for God is another. Benedictine monasticism values stability, good works, faithfulness. They sound like humble virtues, and if they are, that's good, because humility and humbleness is something else that the Benedictines value very much. How do they come to this? By obedience and humility. In the very prologue of this little rule, Benedict writes that you should run on the path of God's commandments with your hearts overflowing with the inexpressible desire of love. And when you see the kids running down the hill, it gives your heart a sort of different leap. But there is that sort of running on the path with your heart overflowing with the inexpressible joy. Take more, take more. Right. And then these vows, the ones we generally hear: poverty, chastity, obedience, fidelity. These are the kinds of things that people who go to live in a monastery promise. And it sounds very negative. My 18 to 22-year-old students are not, very big on saying no, saying no, I don't want that. And yet, many of them are athletes. Many of them are involved in musical organizations that require them to say, no, I won't do that. Those are things that will prevent me from achieving the goals that I have. And I think both musical ensembles and athletics are fine examples here, because they are both situations in which the individual's ability to do what they've promised, what he or she has promised to do, is important to everybody being able to do what they have in common. And in fact, this whole idea of monasticism and asceticism, saying no, is related to the athlete, to be in training, to be able to run on the path. So that the running, again, we have this mixing together. The running is both the training and the thing. It's both. So the vows, as I said, the ones we hear about, poverty, chastity, and obedience, are to cut away what inhibits growth. It's a kind, you could think of it, we're going to go on with this horticultural metaphor, it's a kind of pruning. Right, getting rid of the things that aren't helpful in bearing fruit. So why would one vow poverty? Well, to get rid of the longing for goods. Right? How many of us say, I hear myself say it all the time, this house is too big. It's taking over my life. Right? Now, what I did was hire someone to clean it. But I'm not courageous enough, I guess, to just say, less house, get rid of this house. But a vow of poverty, and the vow for the Benedictines, of course, was individual poverty. And if we look at the whole history of the Benedictines, what we discover is that individual poverty and corporate, how shall I put it, industriousness resulted in great corporate wealth. And so there's a cycle of reform. That cycle of reform is, we could think of it analogously to this running on the paths of God, pruning away. We each do it individually. The community has to do it over and over again too. So that poverty, chastity, to cut away preference and passion, the kind of temptation to idolatry of the senses, temptation to the idolatry of narrowing our vision only to one person. Now, this probably is not something that most of us who don't join a monastery are going to say, I'm going to take that on, right? And I'm not suggesting that a vow of celibacy may be what we want to take on, but we may realize in a society in which all goods are sold by reference to sexuality that there's something we need to do here, okay? And then thirdly, the vow of obedience to cut away willfulness, to cut away egoism, to let to let go of it, to be made free of those things. If you've been out on a long backpack, you know when you lift that off, you know it's like your shoulders, whoosh, right up to the moon. And that's what I think these vows are about, to take away what pushes us down or what distracts us. Okay. And then I also want to say something about organization of time for works of hand, mind, and heart. Well, I can expand it on my points instead of just pointing to them. But now, let's go back then to Benedict and his times. We know very little about the man Boniface. He lived about 200 years, Benedict, he lived about 200 years earlier than Boniface, around 500. It's a nice round number. He lived in Italy. He was probably a nobleman. We know that he was a man who was devoted to God. He lived for a period as a hermit. He gathered several communities together. So he was experienced in this desire for God, this running on the paths of God. And it shows in what he writes in his rule. He also drew not only on his own experience, but on what by this time was several hundred years of Christian monastic tradition. And I'm not going to go back and do that whole history of monasticism, or we won't even get past that. I didn't bring it because I think there's only one copy of it left in the bookstore, but there is a wonderful book there. I think the title is something like Spiritual Traditions for Today's Christians. It's white. Jan can help you find it. And it has a section on the Benedictines, a section on Ignatius, a section on Luther, a section on Wesley. And that has a brief but very helpful history of monasticism. All I want to say about the previous forms is that in the East, we have the desert tradition, which is much more the hermit tradition. And I would, now I'm going to sound like this big commercial, but Roberta Bondi is the person who makes this just sing. I mean, we have several of her books in the library. She was here last summer and taught out of those books, and those tapes are you should pray for a rainy day so that you'll be happy to sit in the tape library and listen to Roberta Bondi talk about the hermit tradition and the singularity and practicality of those desert hermits. But Benedict has a different kind of monasticism. His time is after the Emperor Constantine, so Christianity has been established to a certain degree as the preferred religion of the empire. But the empire is in decline. As so often seems to happen, you know, just when you think you're going to make it, then the thing you're making it to begins to fade away and crumble. And that's happening in the Roman Empire. There's a sort of breakdown of civilization. Things feel in chaos. And Benedict writes this little book for beginners that has endured long after those times. So as a historian, I'm always thinking, well, you have to look at the context. But this book clearly has endured long past its original context. It was important for 1,000 years in Europe, both when the life that the rules suggest matched what was, first, it's an alternative to chaos, and then it matches feudalism. It matches very, very well. Many characteristics of this social organization are just parallels to medieval feudalism, but it continues to have power in our time when the society around it is characterized by individualism, capitalism, very different. And so again, it's a kind of alternative that offers us, I think, a very healthy critique. Now, it does use the language of empire, monarchy, the myth of the crown that we've talked about a little before, but it uses it as an alternative. So that in the prologue, Benedict writes, armed with the strong and noble weapons of obedience to do battle for the true king, Christ the Lord. So he uses this military image, but he's putting it over against someone else who would be the king. However, that's not pervasive. I don't think it shapes this nearly as much as the Ignatian worldview is shaped by a kind of military model. And indeed, as this develops, it's very interesting. There are two ecclesial structures that develop in medieval Europe. One is, again, this kind of pyramid that we have with the myth of the crown. And of course, at the top is the Pope. And then there are the cardinals and the archbishops and the bishops and the parish priests and the parishioners. Right? And it just works out so nicely because there are so many more parishioners than there is a pope. It's a nice stable. But the Benedictine model is like this. There are all these little houses, and each one has its abbot or abbess. So interestingly, both of these have as its leader someone whose title is father. Right, but it's a different father, and there are many examples throughout medieval history of these coming into conflict, because of course they aren't that separate. The Pope claims to be over all of that. Some of these are outside; they're their own. They're like they have diplomatic immunity or something. They're their own little country. So we have those two different things developing simultaneously.
Yeah, and that's still one of the biggest conflicts up at St. John's is between the diocese and the monastery.
Yep.
So.
Yep. Yeah, and it's perpetuated not only with the monasteries in the United States, but with the way Roman Catholicism was developed in the U.S., that some of the parish churches are run by orders.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll not all of them monastic in the strict sense, because Franciscans, the mendicant orders, aren't strictly speaking monasticism, but they share some similar characteristics. Okay. Nonetheless, we do have that military reference. It's there a little bit in the tent of God, too, as the military tent, although I prefer to think of that as more like the tabernacle, that God goes with us as nomads. Of course, that goes very nicely with the tree of life, that you pitch your tent under the tree of life. Okay. There is that kind of dichotomous view, like we saw in the Didache. Okay, here's the way of life, there's the way of death. And yet, Benedictine monasticism is incredibly attentive to the reality and specificity of life in this world. In a particular climate with specific people who have particular characteristics and weaknesses and abilities. Oh, I gotta speed up. Okay, there's a lot of concern about how you live and specific instructions about what to eat, what to wear, what you're allowed to do, what you're not allowed to do, when to do what is allowed and what to do if someone does what they're not supposed to do. And yet, it's very, very adaptable. I skipped over this. We think of monastics as people who withdraw, right? Who go away. And yet, monasticism is filled with concern not only for this world, but for other people. In the medieval time, of course, that meant education, healing, prayer, very importantly prayer, and hospitality, which some of us talked about yesterday. And I want to read you this lovely description of the porter, because it's a good example of the realism and wisdom that pervades the whole book. So the porter of the monastery. At the door of the monastery, place a sensible old man who knows how to take a message and deliver a reply, and whose age keeps him from roaming about. This porter will need a room near the entrance so that visitors will always find him there to answer them. As soon as anyone knocks or a poor man calls out, he replies, "Thanks be to God," or "Your blessing, please." Then, with all the gentleness that comes from the fear of God, he provides a prompt answer with the warmth of love. Let the porter be given one of the younger brothers if he needs help. The monastery should, if possible, be so constructed that within it all necessities such as water, mill, and garden are contained, and the various crafts are practiced. Then there will be no need for the monks to roam outside, because this is not at all good for their souls. We wish this rule to be read often in the community so that none of the brothers can offer the excuse of ignorance. Now, there's this wonderful combination of expectation of high perfection and realism about, well, you know, doesn't always happen. And that pervades the whole of the book. It's in the instructions about sleeping. Don't sleep with your knife on. Don't let the younger brothers sleep all together, right? Because, I don't know, they poke each other and it's hard for them to get up, right? Very, very practical. The description about people who are sick, this one is quite splendid as well. And I want to read it in part because it must be 59, not chapter. I team taught this with a colleague from the French department. It was a first year seminar. And after we read the rule, she had the students take a section from our student handbook and rewrite it as if it was in the rule. And you saw the contrast between this focus and our student handbook section on what to do if you get sick. The student handbook is clearly written for a student's parents' attorneys. It's very clear. It's all about protecting us from liability. Now listen to this. The sick brothers. Care of the sick must rank above and before all else, so that they may truly be served as Christ. For he said, "I was sick and you visited me. And what you did for one of the least of these brothers, you did for me." Let the sick put on their part, bear in mind, that they are served out of honor for God. And let them not, by their excessive demands, distress their brothers who serve them. Still, sick brothers must be patiently borne with, because serving them leads to a greater reward. Consequently, the abbot should be extremely careful that they suffer no neglect. Let a separate room be designated for the sick, and let them be served by an attendant who is God-fearing, attentive, and concerned. The sick may take baths whenever it is advisable, but the healthy, and especially the young, should receive permission less readily. Moreover, to regain their strength, the sick who are very weak may eat meat, but when their health improves, they should all abstain from meat as usual. So again, there's this wonderful attentiveness, not just to the details, but to the underlying concerns, right? Take care of the sick because they're sick, but also because Jesus told you to, right? Okay, now we could go on and on reading our favorite things. One of my favorite parts is about the reader, because I'm not a singer, so I take great delight in the care with which Benedict points out who should be the reader. Because it seems like we all think anybody can read in church, but only singers can sing. I'm not being very humble on that point. Okay. It's also important, not just the time in which the book was written, but the individual's time of life. And Benedict writes about that, saying, "You should come when you're ready to give up your own will once and for all. To join the monastery is not easy. Very hard, and the chapter about receiving new members is quite detailed. They come to the door and they have to knock for 4 or 5 days before you let them in. And then you read them the whole rule so that they can't offer the excuse of ignorance. And then a few more months go by. It's a long process. And then once you're finally ready to stay, you give everything away. Right? Burn your bridges behind you when you start on this path." Leadership is also something that's very interesting in this book. And we tend to think about monasticism from the perspective of the members. But as I've gotten older and acquired responsibilities, I have come more and more to treasure about this book what it says about leadership and how to exercise leadership. Anne referred yesterday in her session to Max Dupre's work on leadership, and I don't know that he reads Benedict's rule, but he has some similar tone in his books about leadership. He talks about you have to have the courage to abandon yourself to other people's crazy ideas. No. Now, the abbot isn't given precisely that advice, but there's a similarity, I think. The abbot is selected by the whole community to represent Christ. That's the similarity with this kind of model, is that this person stands to represent Christ, and then the abbot is instructed very closely. Don't tell people to do things you wouldn't do. There's a heavy obligation there. The abbot is instructed to lead by word and example. And then when there are big decisions to be made, to ask everyone, because God most often speaks to the young. And then the rule says, in unimportant matters, you can just ask the senior members. Totally contrary to what most of us have as our impulse. Well, this is really important, so we can't ask the people who haven't been around very long. And then there are other leaders as well, and some of those change. So Jerry and I were talking about this since he's been waitry, how he's thought about the advice to those who serve and how they're supposed to stand up at the week at the beginning of the week and ask for the people to pray for them and then again at the end. So that there's a rotation that undermines any kind of inequity. You know that this one sings well and that one reads well, and you'd really rather have this person serve you than that person, and yet everyone gets a turn. Your order in the monastery is by when you joined. It's chronological age in the community, not rank. And that's very important. Worship is also very central here, very, very important. But rather than what we saw in the Didache with that focus on the sacraments, in the monastic community, it's a daily rhythm of prayer that comes out more or less to every 3 hours to stop and pray, to to get up in the middle of the night and pray, something I didn't appreciate very much until I was the mother of a child who didn't sleep through the night till he was 3 and a half. And I began to understand something about how that rhythm would shape your day. Now, I unfortunately couldn't get my son to do it on a regular schedule. So at least the monks know it's at that time. Although some of that changes by the time of year, right? Just like the food changes by what work you do. And the clothes change by the, if you live in the north, you should have more clothes than if you live in the south. This rhythm of prayer and work and eating and sleeping makes time for everything. So it's all of a piece. Again, monasticism as life focused on one thing. It's all work. It's all peace, punctuated by prayer, but not separated from prayer. I think that's really something that most of us can't imagine. Time enough for everything. Dorothy Bass, was up here earlier this summer, has been doing a lot of work on the practice of keeping Sabbath and has expanded that to think more about all the things we do related to time. And again, I would commend to you her tapes. She said, we think this is a problem of organizing. And I know I'm that. I think I find the perfect calendar. Now my life will work. I have the perfect calendar. And I really do have a calendar I think is quite splendid. But I noticed that it doesn't solve everything. There's still 24 hours in a day. And I'm still rushing. And I listen to people say, well, double task. Do two things at once. Well, you know what that does? It makes us more exhausted, more tired, more fragmented. And the Benedictine way is, at this hour we pray, and then we eat, and then we're quiet, and then we read, and in the season of Lent, everyone goes to the library and is assigned a book. And you read that during Lent. You read it slowly. You read it not speed reading to see how many pages you can get through, but you read it slowly so that you understand it, so it enters into you. And then about what goes on in worship, it's not self-expression, which many of us Protestants find very difficult. Worship is not self-expression. It's not me here showing my spiritual insight to everyone. Rather, it's participation in the life of the body of Christ. There's a beautiful evening hymn that I think suggests this. The day you gave us, Lord, is ending. You know that one? And it has this great line, your church unsleeping while the earth rolls onward into light. Through all the world its watch is keeping. The voice of prayer is never silent, nor dies the strain of praise away. So that around the globe, through time, there's this constancy of prayer. It allows us to relax. Somebody is praying. Right. The Psalms also provide continuity and variety. And this, listening to Anne talk about improvisation, I was thinking of, I can't wait till I get to my session so I can make this point about the Psalms in worship. That if you pray through all the Psalms in a week, you think, God, that's really boring. But it's not unlike what Gary was saying about improvisation. You learn it. It becomes part of you. You have words. And it's not, some of them are the same every day, but some aren't. So that there's a wonderful intermixing of novelty and familiarity. Okay. Already talked about other kinds of reading. And then simply to emphasize that the prayer is work. the prayer is one of the things that is the community's work. It's a different work. It's the work of the heart, if you'll allow that kind of ripping apart of the human person. But it's not something you make time for. It is what you do. Okay, so I've spewed out to you a whole bunch of stuff about these people, and given you some questions, although these may not be the ones you want to comment on. What do we value? How do we guard against its opposite? What's the role of the community in that? And then what about worship? When you think about running on the path of God, what are the things that make that hard? How do you guard against them? I'll just leave that open for you, I hope.
I found it really hard to do.
Why is that?
Well, because it wasn't easy and it's not my piety. I mean, I spent 5 months at St. John's and frankly finally had to admit that I could go on Sundays and maybe once a week. But that finding that time for prayer and our days were wide open. This was on sabbatical and we were really encouraged to take the 8 hours for work, the rest of the day off. I mean, even the institute that Kathleen Norris, the same place Norris writes about in the Cloister Walk. And I think when you come out of a really busy, hectic life to sit, I mean, it's just a whole different feeling. So I found it difficult because I don't sit still very long. And, you know, then to do it that frequently, some of the people on sabbatical felt very comfortable with it. But I never did really completely ease into it. I loved it and I was glad to be there, but I can't honestly say that it would take me a lot longer time to get used to it.
And I think certainly we don't, if you want to be a Benedictine, then probably you go and join a Benedictine order. Mm-hmm. But partly what I'm interested in is how these tools that the Benedictines have, like regular prayer, the use of the Psalms, this understanding of work, this way of thinking about leadership, how we can use those. Certainly as Protestants, many of us, even those of us who are post-Vatican II Protestants, have a little skittishness because we think, well, isn't that what we were trying to get rid of? Insofar as you think that monasticism is a better life, a life that makes us more acceptable to God, yeah, that's what we're trying to get rid of. But if we're willing to say, it may help us not to become the rain, but once we are the rain, not to become the tree, but once we are the tree, how do you cultivate the tree? How do you keep it going? Yeah. Jerry.
I became an oblate of St. Andrew's Abbey in Vallejo, California, 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And the monk who I've known for 30 years guided me in the process of formation, and very wise 80-year-old.
Yeah.
Who instructed me to write my own version of the rule and that I should include these things. How will I pray daily?
Mm-hmm.
How will I listen to the scripture daily?
Mm-hmm.
How will I live within my covenants, my marriage, and my family? How will I live my vocation, my work, and how will I practice hospitality? How will our home, to the extent that it could become a place of hospitality.
And that's five, is that five questions?
Yeah. And that I should return to it at the beginning of every Lenten season.
Yeah.
I think that I was drawn to it for factors that were very powerful in our life, my life. And I found in it tools that my own tradition doesn't really support. and doesn't seem to really know what to do with. So, and I find it very natural to live that life and remain in my own tradition, which certainly as an oblate I'm encouraged to do. But just touching on those things, I have kind of come to a different sense of what those three basic commitments are in terms of stability, which you mentioned, stability of life in a community, and obedience, recognizing that the root of obedience is listening, audience, and then conversion of life daily to Christ. You know, so those kind of really enter into things.
And I think that's very consistent with what we see even going on in the rule. Mm-hmm. Benedict's attention to particularity.
Yeah.
And the first reading tends to focus on the prohibition. It seems rough and hard. But a second and third reading, we began to see all these little adaptations and attentiveness to this tree in this soil.
It helps to allow oneself to be guided too by someone like Joan Chittister.
Oh, I meant to talk about Chittister, so thank you.
Who is a Benedictine nun in Pennsylvania. I'm in my third reading through the rule with her commentary, and she very naturally links it so much to our family life, to our community life, to our workplace, you know, and helps deal with some of what, you know, I recognize is there that seems so harsh to our ears. But the other, one of the other positions that I really appreciate in the monastery, and it applies so much to Holden, is the cellarer, who is the person who carries out the kind of stewardship for the distribution of tools, of clothing, of goods, of taking care of things, and the strong tradition that the vessels on the altar are, the vessels in the kitchen are as sacred as the vessels on the altar. And that's one way to kind of see the natural weaving in and out of common life and spirit and the life of worship. And it's so evident here that we need such a stewardship and a wise sense of how that gets distributed, because Benedict says there are going to be people who have needs that other people don't have, and the cellarer has to be the one to kind of live that out.
Yeah, and the chapter on the distribution of goods, he writes, whoever needs, see, there's, by this we do not mean to imply that there should be favoritism, God forbid, but rather consideration for weakness. Whoever needs less should thank God and not be distressed, but whoever needs more should feel humble because of his weakness, not self-important because of the kindness shown him. That wonderful. And Chittister, one of the wonderful things about Chittister is the way she's able to say, the Benedictine life is not for virtuosos. Okay? And there's a certain understanding of monasticism, in part focused on that desert tradition and the idea that the monastics are the white martyrs, those who gave up their life are the red martyrs, you know, who shed their blood, and then the monastics, men and women, are the ones whose holiness comes by this other. But Chittister, I think, makes very clear that it's not about virtuosity. This is an ordinary life.
Yeah. Her other book, Wisdom
Distilled from the Daily.
It's more down there.
Yeah, Wisdom Distilled from the Daily, which is where she writes in a more essay form rather than the commentary on the rule itself. And we may have one or two copies left of that in the bookstore. It's a very fine piece. You'd find lots of stuff by Joan Chittister. She's done recently the text for some beautiful books of art, I think on the Stations of the Cross. Yeah.
I bought that book 3 years ago as a recommendation from you two.
Oh.
And just loved it.
Isn't that awesome?
And the other thing I noticed, too, about your leadership comments, one thing I learned a lot from the sisters at St. Benedict's was a sort of different model for feminism. Remember one of their great stories, first of all, their chapel is just a wonderful example of how they sort of took Vatican II liturgy and made it for their own leadership style. But remember they'd say, well, the abbot would send over the man, the priest, and she said occasionally, once in a while we get one we don't like, so we just send him back. They just don't celebrate Mass that day.
Yeah.
And it was just, you know, it's not an overt, in-your-face, anger sort of thing. It's just, well, we just sent him back. And it was, I think, an example of this kind of leadership that's very diverse and spread out. And they can do things up at the monastery, at the, you know, that, for instance, we could take communion at the church, at the abbot, I'm not thinking very clearly, but when we'd go to the seminary, which was on St. John's campus, we were not allowed to take communion because, and I'm Lutheran, so I could go commune with the monks, but if I went and communed with at the seminary, because the diocesan office was watching very clearly what was going on, and they had a reminder that non-Catholics were not allowed to commune at the seminary.
Right.
But there was this kind of tongue-in-cheek plan because you could just go next door.
Right.
Where most of the people went for worship anyway.
And this, I have a good friend and colleague who has become an oblate at St. John's who describes himself as a Methobacterian. Comes from Methobacterian. He's Methodist, Baptist, Presbyterian. He's from Georgia and North Florida. Some of you will have met him. And this thing about communion has been very interesting because they have welcomed him to commune. And yet he says, I don't get this real presence business. If any of you were up here with my friend Chuck Yehoff last summer, he was cornering everyone saying, now this real presence business, what do you make of that? What do you make of that? Because he'd been welcomed, but he wasn't willing yet to come. It was very odd because he communes other places, but somehow at St. John's, it was really important to him to figure that out. This, I think all of that emphasizes for us the time we're in. This Tree of Life theme, of course, is about a new age, the eschatological, apocalyptic end of the age. My series about bearing the fruit of the tree is to say, okay, well, fine, yeah, there's sometime Jesus returns, that's great, but in the meantime, here we are. It is, however, a different time than Benedict lived in, and it's a different time than Luther lived in, and it's a different, I think, of my dear seminary professor, Paul Sinek, who told us about he was going to take this Catholic girl to a dance, and his father grabbed him like this, you know, and Paul is a huge guy. I can't imagine this. He wasn't supposed to dance, and he wasn't supposed to have anything to do with Catholics. So this was very, very bad. We don't live in that time anymore, and one of the wonderful things that opens to us is precisely, you know, what Jerry has said and what my friend Jackie Hoff says and what you experienced. And we all, I know that Roy and Dorothy, who's their synod office is in a Franciscan house. What we experience is this wonderful hospitality or living together under the tree and saying, well, here, you know, try this mango. You know, maybe that will be good. Try it. Taste and see, you know. And I don't mean by that to encourage a sort of mindless eclecticism where you just take this and take that, and Anne's talked about listening to the blues, and you don't just take somebody's stuff and not pay attention to where it comes from and where it's rooted. And again, the horticultural metaphor is really good because you take, I always say, well, that's a beautiful, you know, foxglove. I'd like to have those foxgloves at my house, and you don't take any root. You push that cut flower into the ground. It's not coming back next year. It's just not. You got to think about how that all works together. Well, tonight we have opportunity to take part in one of Holden's newer but coming to be beloved rhythms of worship, namely prayer around the cross. So I want to let you go. But thank you very much. And I hope, as always at Holden, that the conversation goes out of the room rather than being finished when you go through the door. So thank you.
Thank you.